You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Sociopath, a memoir by Patrick Gagné. That Patrick Gagné is a sociopath isn't news. She wrote about it for the New York Times Modern Love column, which led to a deal for a book that I have just hurled across the room like a discus, and an extensive pre-publication interview with my colleague David Marchese. Gagné seems to be afflicted, or blessed, with hyperthymesia, a.k.a. a highly superior autobiographical memory, a rare condition publicized in an old 60 Minutes segment featuring the actress Mary Lou Henner. How else, unless Gagné was concealing a small tape recorder on her person since childhood, does she recall decades-old dialogue in such precise detail? Not out of the question, of course, for a sociopath. And incidentally, how come so much of that is rat-a-tat-tat banter suitable for a corny 90s rom-com? I'd kill myself if everywhere I went people knew who I was. Gagné, who in young adulthood follows her father into the music business, tells a flirtatious rock guitarist to whom she's confided her sociopathy. "Instead of killing other people, you mean?" he replies. Rimshot. The ostensible goal of sociopath, as the memoir is titled in dramatic Sharpie letters on the cover, is to address exactly this sort of misconception, to destigmatize an oft misunderstood personality type. Most of Gagné's kind are not murderers. She argues that sociopathy is a spectrum disorder, like autism, affecting millions, though there's no source for this number. Citation in sociopath is not footnotes, but excited flipping through library books. Other than stabbing a neighborhood terror in the head with a pencil when she was in second grade, flinging a glass pitcher at a wall, and occasionally clawing herself in frustration to the point of bleeding, Gagné has tended to be more creepy than violent in her transgressive behavior. Relief from a certain temperamental blankness has come, she writes, by breaking into other people's homes and joyriding in their dubiously borrowed cars. "The silence of a structure that has just been broken into is unlike any other," the author writes, adding with unnerving humanization, "It's almost like the house can't believe what just happened and has gasped, taking all the air with it." Gagné tells of stealing and stockpiling trivial objects, like a pair of Ringo Starr's glasses when she was a toddler, and as an adult, a Statue of Liberty keychain that she used to signal to her watchful then-boyfriend David when she's done something unorthodox. David, no saint, also joined her for sex in the empty houses. Gagné mulled filching a life-size ceramic tiger from Hugh Hefner's office during a party at the Playboy Mansion, but settled for a notepad. Some people crash weddings for the free food and drinks. She sneaks into funerals, strangers' grief washing over her like a spa cleanse. There's an elaborate subplot about Gagné stalking a woman named Ginny who's trying to extort her father, the revelation that causes the obviously enchanted guitarist to do a spit take, spit takes being about as common in real life as rim shots. Indeed, a large swath of sociopath is devoted to Gagné's ability to succeed amid the dark magic of the music business, which, we're reminded, tends to attract difficult personalities, such as that guitarist, she dubs him Max Magus, for whom she may or may not be leaving dependable David. You've heard the phrase, "has no chill"? Gagné portrays herself as all chill, a blonde, ferret-toting Wednesday Addams, as she writes of an upbringing stressed by divorce and a move to Florida. Her younger sister, Harlow, nicknames her Captain Apathy, drawing a cartoon of a masked superhero. Somebody dial Mattel. Like Diana, in a chorus line, Patrick feels nothing, happiness and anger in brief spurts maybe, but not empathy or remorse, a syndrome she likens to bad eyesight. She does, however, curse an awful lot, sometimes in all caps. One woman is dismissed as a basic bitch, and worse. Competition and weather reports, The breeze whistled its approval as I approached the sports car, blight the narrative. And when Gagne, now a clinical psychologist and married mother of two, writes of her longing for incarceration, a short stint in lockup sounded interesting. One wishes someone had gently placed a few more studies on her library pile. Sociopathy is no longer indexed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, Gagne writes, replaced by Antisocial Personality Disorder, several criteria of which don't resonate with her. She guards her medical identity like a ceramic tiger, scornfully labeling a messy record label executive named Jennifer a sociopath, a term the author is attempting to trademark. I have little problem with sociopath as a porthole into the unusual mind of one woman, albeit a smudged porthole, she admits to changing names, dates, and details. It's when Gagne swerves the wheel of that purloined auto into the scholarly realm, speeding through the psychiatrist Hervey Cleckley's 1941 seminal work on psychopathy, The Mask of Sanity, and topics like cognitive behavioral therapy, that sweat begins to bead on my boringly neurotypical forehead. Those Sharpie letters proclaim a PhD in clinical psychology, but since her dissertation is not available online nor referenced by other scholars, sociopath is venturing out into the hot media lights uncomfortably alone. This is an important topic, treated too flightily, begging for peer review, not book review. This review was written by Alexandra Jacobs, who is a Times book critic and occasional features writer. She joined the Times in 2010. Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball by Keith O'Brien. It isn't easy mustering sympathy for Pete Rose. He was a compulsive gambler who bet on the team he managed, the Cincinnati Reds, then lied about it for years. He was also a compulsive liar. He had a sexual relationship with a teenage girl and barely acknowledged the child he had with another woman out of wedlock. He was a self-pitying, sore loser who abandoned friends once they were no longer useful to him, including the worshipful errand runners who enabled his gambling habit. This is the Rose who emerges in Keith O'Brien's new book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. The book is a mixture of disillusioned fans' notes, investigative reportage, and baseball history. The author grew up in Cincinnati, rooting for Rose during his prime playing days with the Reds in the 1960s and 70s. It paints a picture of an unchecked man-child with no desire to curb his appetites. But that would make for a pretty boring story in itself, and O'Brien, who has previously written about the Love Canal environmental disaster in Paradise Falls and the pioneering female aviators in Fly Girls, is not a boring writer or thinker. Without overtly trumpeting his themes, O'Brien has crafted a sort of American tragedy about an undersized athlete raised to win at all costs, coddled by his blue-collar community, an overly accommodating press corps, and fans won over by his all-out style of play. Rose was known for running to first base when he drew a walk and diving into the other bases headfirst, except in the 1970 All-Star Game, when he scored a winning run by plowing into catcher Ray Fosse, delivering a devastating shoulder injury in the process. Rose's father was a Cincinnati semi-pro football legend who preached constant effort, and the son often seemed to be playing on the gridiron, not the diamond. He could not admit defeat. This proved to be his fatal flaw when he stubbornly refused to acknowledge that he had bet on baseball. The league banned him for his sins in 1989. His dishonesty and lack of repentance made the decision a lot easier. By the time he confessed, the damage to his career and legacy was more than done. Working with newly released FBI files, previously unutilized federal court documents, and more than 150 hours of interviews, including 27 hours with Rose, who cooperated with the author until he decided he didn't want to, O'Brien tells a tale that runs on parallel tracks. One is Rose's baseball career, his skill with a bat, which led him to break Ty Cobb's career hit record in 1985, his pivotal role in Cincinnati's Big Red Machine, which won the World Series in 1975 and 1976, and the nonstop way he played, which earned him the nickname Charlie Hustle. The moniker was conceived in derision by the Yankee greats Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford, amused by Rose's rah-rah play during a 1963 spring training game. Rose would come to wear it with pride. The other Rose story involves bookies, gamblers, low-level gangsters, hangers-on, cocaine and steroid addicts, and what Rose's Hall of Fame teammate Johnny Bench referred to as bad guys in an off-the-record 1975 conversation with the broadcaster Kurt Gowdy. For much of the book, such characters pop in and out of the action, seeding the path as Rose closes in on the hit record and baseball immortality. Then the bad guys take over the action. Rose's unpaid debts pile up, and he refuses to pay some of them. A pair of Rose devotees, Tommy Giosa and Paul Jansen, both of whom spoke extensively with O'Brien, run his errands, placing his bets, helping him juggle women, and eventually encountering their own reckoning with law enforcement. Jansen grows tired of Rose's neglect and cooperates with an investigation that makes clear that Rose bet on the Reds. As the two tracks converge, O'Brien deftly builds suspense and narrative friction. There are heroes here as well. One is Bart Giamatti, the Renaissance literature scholar and university president at Yale, who became commissioner of Major League Baseball and gave Rose every opportunity to come clean, but came down hard when it was time to exile him from the game. Giamatti, the father of the Oscar-nominated actor Paul Giamatti, died of a heart attack just 8 days after Rose's banishment. A baseball romantic who usually had a literary allusion to the ready, the Giamatti of these pages also possesses an iron will and, unlike Rose, a zest for the truth. "I will be told that I am an idealist," Giamatti said upon issuing his ruling. "I hope so." By book's end, the Hit King has become an autograph machine, scrawling his name on anything to keep the cash flowing in. For a little extra money, he'd add an inscription. "I'm sorry I bet on baseball," O'Brien writes. He signs the same inscription night after night and day after day, at show after show and in town after town. He signs it and he signs it until he cannot sign it anymore. One thinks of Robert De Niro's gone to see Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull, rehearsing patter for his nightclub act, far from his boxing glory. The phrase, "the last glory days of baseball," in the subtitle feels more like marketing spin than actual content of the book. The author is too clear-eyed to engage in easy nostalgia, but that doesn't mean he is dispassionate. As O'Brien writes, "I have felt just about every emotion about Pete Rose, pride, disgust, frustration, pity, and confusion. Only one thing hasn't changed over the years, my fascination with his story." This fascination, not the emotion, guides Charlie Hustle. O'Brien gives us a Willie Loman with spikes, chugging toward a cliff and blinded to his fate. This review was written by Chris Vognar. He is a freelance culture writer, lifelong baseball fan, and former Nieman Arts and Culture Fellow at Harvard University. The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. For those unacquainted with Catholic demonology, a familiar, or familiar spirit, as the phrase shows up in the Bible, is an otherworldly creature indentured to a master, usually whoever summoned it, a witch or necromancer, or, in the case of Aladdin, a lucky rube who finds a bottle in need of a shine. In Leigh Bardugo's richly drawn novel of magic and eternal love, the familiar, the Aladdin of the story, is Lucia, a scullion girl working for fallen nobility in 16th century Spain. Spells and enchantments come to Lucia with ease, initially manifesting as small remedies to household gaffes. A burned loaf of bread is suddenly edible. A ripped seam repairs itself. She's wildly gifted, but has little control of her abilities. Enter Gulian St. Angel, a familiar bound to serve Victor Depardes, an ambitious tradesman known throughout Madrid for his astonishing luck. The Depardes family has owned St. Angel for 3 generations, employing him as an invaluable henchman, fixer, and bringer of otherworldly good fortune. Known as El Alacrán, the Scorpion, St. Angel is an indomitable force with a voice like ashes gone cold, who looks at once beautiful and like he was dying, as if a sheet had been laid over a particularly handsome corpse. When Depardes selects Lucia to compete as his holy champion in a torneo of magic at the luxurious La Casilla, a contest with life or death stakes, St. Angel is enlisted to guide her. In the process, he becomes her protector, mentor, and friend. Lucia, described by one character as a wolf who has taken the shape of a girl, makes for an unlikely sorceress. She lacks formal education and is as ignorant of her potential as she is of her origins. Lucia's ancestors were, it turns out, conversos, Jews forced to convert to Catholicism, but still considered the embodiment of everything the Inquisition reviled. Although her parents are dead, Lucia's aunt has taught her the precious, perilous scraps of language that form the basis of her spells, a music she hears but doesn't fully understand. At La Casilla, Lucia must hide her origins and her intelligence. She dresses with prim severity in a plain black dress and a white ruff, like a Renaissance-era Coco Chanel, hoping to seem less threatening. Lucia may disguise herself, but her talent shatters any hope that she will go unnoticed. She's a sensation from the first, drawing the ire of ruthless competitors. Navigating the tourneo's Machiavellian politics is no easy feat, and it doesn't help that she's falling for St. Angel. He's pretty hard to resist. Equals in magic and subterfuge, they are both trapped in their own ways. He, too, is lonely. Immortality has nearly killed him, leaving him to forget the pleasure of warm skin, conversation, the glimmering of connection. Their growing intimacy forms a bond that will save them both. Bardugo, whose Gothic fiction includes Ninth House and the young adult novels Shadow and Bone and Six of Crows, is perfectly at home in the 16th century. Her prose mirrors the Baroque setting, her sentences lush and embroidered with pearls. Subplots proliferate, characters appear and retreat, and points of view shift from one person to the next, creating a panopticon around Lucia and St. Angel. Reading Bardugo is an immersive, sensual experience. There are orange blossom-scented dreams, jewel-encrusted velvet dresses, fabrics dyed with turmeric and berries from Persia more purple than a bruise, a pomegranate's perfectly glossy seeds begging to be eaten. One can't help sinking into Lucia and St. Angel's world and wishing never to leave. This review was written by Danielle Trussoni, who is the author of 7 books. The Wives, a memoir by Simone Gorindo. Sometimes I think about joining the military, Simone Gorindo's boyfriend, Andrew, tells her early in their relationship. I would leave you, Gorindo says. But 6 years later, Andrew is on a mission with a special operations unit in Afghanistan, and the couple, now married, have moved from their Manhattan apartment to a rented house in Columbus, Georgia, near Fort Benning. Gorindo's memoir, The Lives, tells the story of the years she spent adjusting to a new culture and to a new role, military wife. Arriving in Columbus with an editing background and a master's in journalism, she's immediately attuned to the language that keeps her subservient. I didn't want to be a dependent, my presence in this world sponsored, but dependent I was. Already my days revolve around waiting for him to call. Those days are hot and long. There are loops in the park, bike rides to the Piggly Wiggly, where groceries cost too much, and there are those Gorindo is left with for company, the wives. But despite its title, The Wives is a self-portrait. We meet the other women and share in Gorindo's deepening connections with her own unit. But even as Gorindo becomes one of the wives, she remains an observer. We learn that this stance is a familiar one for the author, who grew up in Marin County, surrounded by privilege, but not of it. Her parents struggled to make ends meet. They fought. Her mother drank. As a child, Grindo would wait by the window for her mother, fearing the worst and willing her to arrive. 20 years later, in Columbus, Grindo uneasily occupies the same spot, waiting for Andrew to come home every night, the way I did with my mom. Grindo's prose is inviting and fluid, and her storytelling is intimate and vivid. But while she renders her own history with insight, the other wives are drawn with less nuance. Rachel, who starts out as Grindo's across-the-street neighbor, is the fullest presence on the page, especially once Grindo becomes pregnant. The book is excellent on severe anxiety during pregnancy. Grindo feels betrayed every time Andrew leaves for a deployment. She longs for her own version of the jittery aliveness that characterizes his days. And as time goes on, all of the deferral, both to a culture and of her own needs, changes her. One afternoon at a book club, another wife announces that she has no voice with her husband. "In the past, I probably would have spoken up," Grindo writes. "You should have a voice," I would have said, softly or stridently, depending on my mood. But now I sat silent. As I read Grindo's memoir, I kept thinking of other wife books like Lives of the Wives or Wifedom, or Parallel Lives, the kind of books that foreground the unseen intellectual or creative contributions of women attached to male writers or artists. A military wife, too, offers support for her husband's work, but it is a different kind of unseen labor. What comes across powerfully in Grindo's telling is the labor of accommodation and compliance. In time, Grindo refines her own voice, and ultimately she confronts Andrew, a changed Andrew, both more filled out and more beat up, an Andrew who chews tobacco and owns a gun. "His whole life," she charges, "is designed to keep me from actually knowing you, and the way the unit expects me to be, all quiet and capable and resilient, is designed to keep you from knowing me. Do you know how that makes me feel?" In couples therapy, they successfully work on their personal problems. It's less clear how Grindo addresses a philosophical one. She tells us she'd pushed the boundaries of my own beliefs and ethics to make an extremely conflicted peace with my husband's work. This struggle is mostly offstage. What we see is her distance from that work. In a memorable scene, the wives gather at a Marriott for a lecture by a military psychologist. He's speaking to them as an expert on their husbands. There's some initial laughter about how the military selects for sociopaths, but as the psychologist continues, noting that compartmentalization, the skill that serves the men well on the battlefield, doesn't always translate so well to being a spouse, the room grows still. I spotted one young woman actually taking notes. Our husbands were the maddening puzzles at the center of our lives, and this man understood them. Away from their wives, in dramatic unseen landscapes on secret, dangerous missions, the husbands are changing. But back at home, their wives are changing too, and Grindo argues for the importance of their transformations in her engaging, evocative memoir. This review was written by Susan Burton. She is an editor at This American Life and the author of Empty. Stash, My Life in Hiding by Laura Cathcart Robbins. A Hollywood mom and publicist who felt deeply weighed down by the burden of representing black excellence details her struggles with postpartum depression, addiction, and recovery in an emotionally absorbing and swiftly paced multisensory experience. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.